Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we have a conversation with Illinois' Governor J.B. Pritzker. He'll discuss the new state budget and his vision for the future of Illinois. Also, an investigation found for-profit colleges in Illinois often leave students worse off than when they started. Some say they prey on low-income communities. We'll see how new standards for county juvenile detention centers are affecting one facility. Solar farms, they're becoming more common, but too often take valuable cropland out of production. Studies are happening to address that problem. Soil and water conservation districts in the state lost money in the new state budget. We'll talk with them about the impact that could have. And a group of teachers went on a kayak trip down the Rock River. It's an effort to help them in the classroom. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A lot of black, brown, and low-income students in Illinois who need a college degree to move up in the world go to for-profit colleges to get one. These companies promise a fast track to graduation and a better job, one you can do while you're working the job you already have or raising your kids. But an investigation by member station WBEC found these schools too often leave students worse off than when they started. Lisa Curry and Phillip has more.
After her kid gets on the bus to school, Nika Ewing gets into her car and eventually starts it up.
We gotta do this quite a few times before.
She has just a few hours to make some money picking up and delivering food orders.
One day you'll have it to where as soon as you turn the app on, it's like ding, 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 ding.
It was supposed to be a side hustle while she worked on her software engineering degree at DeVry University. It's a for-profit college chain with campuses across the country.
And then another time you turn on the app and they're giving you like $2 order, $3 orders. I'm not even making gas with that. That's why I'm like, DeVry, something gotta come because I can't keep living like this.
Ewing was pregnant with her first daughter when she saw a commercial on her local news channel for DeVry. It offered the option to get a bachelor's degree in 3 years and promised job placement within 6 months after that. 5 years and tens of thousands of dollars in student loans later, Ewing still doesn't have the degree or a job and is stuck dropping off other people's takeout.
I'm like, so where I'm going? Like, what y'all got lined up for me? And then I was told it was not that at all. So I was like, okay. You know, you feel kind of bamboozled a little bit.
Low-income students and black students like Ewing attend for-profit colleges in Illinois at much higher rates than other groups. WBEZ analyzed federal education data. We found that two-thirds of for-profit schools in Illinois reported their students make less money than a high school graduate. We also surveyed 250 current and former students. We heard that all too often, these schools leave students in low-wage jobs, struggling under mountains of student debt. Aisa Controla-Banez is policy director for the Student Borrower Protection Center.
The for-profit kind of playbook is to meet these communities where they are, capitalize on those lack of infrastructure, lack of funding, lack of opportunities, and then dangle that promise of economic security, economic stability, economic mobility to these same folks. And the results are catastrophic.
Dominique Baker is a higher education researcher at the University of Delaware. She says for-profit schools give the perfect pitch. Take this commercial for DeVry.
A bachelor's degree from DeVry University could change your tomorrow if you do something today.
With our people in those ads have children, they are more often older, and those ads frequently have black women more often than other institutions' ads do. So in every sort of way, these for-profit institutions are creating an image of being incredibly welcoming to black women in particular.
Once students are rushed through the door, the bottom often drops out. For-profits spend so much on advertising, there's not much left for what happens in the classroom. DeVry did not respond to a request for an interview. Some students who filled out our survey had positive experiences with the school. On July 1st, federal officials are introducing new rules to crack down on training programs, those that leave students with a ton of debt and not enough income to pay it back could lose access to federal funding. But that's too little and too late for Ewing. She recently took on work as a house cleaner to make ends meet.
They tell you, oh, in order to get a better job, you need to get an education. You get an education, and that still ain't enough.
Ewing has more than $60,000 in student loans and no idea how she'll pay it back. Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
3 years ago, the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice updated standards for county juvenile detention centers for the first time since 1998. The new standards change requirements for education and mental health care within these facilities and heavily restrict the use of confinement. Jane Carlson tells us about the Mary Davis Home in Galesburg and the progress being made there to comply with the new standards.
The history of the Mary Davis Home dates back more than a century. In 1913, philanthropist Mary Davis McKnight donated a lot and house across from the Knox County Courthouse to be used as a detention home for youth. Today, the modern Mary Davis Home sits at the corner of Locust and Fifth Streets on the southeast side of Galesburg. The large brick building is bordered by cornfields on two sides. It has a library, a gymnasium, and a mural that runs the length of the cafeteria. Youth as young as 10 are housed there while awaiting sentencing in the court system or while serving sentences. It's one of 16 county juvenile detention centers in Illinois. Wendy Stack has worked at the Mary Davis Home for 31 years.
And basically what our job here is to keep them safe and secure while they're here. And what we want to do is through programming is to kind of change their thoughts, their beliefs, and their choices to something more positive.
Stuck fell in love with the work while doing an internship with Knox County Probation and never left. She's now the administrator of the Mary Davis Home. She says the majority of youth housed there are between the ages of 14 and 18, and they stay there anywhere from a few days to a few years. The 39-bed facility typically houses 19 or 20 youth.
Due to our programming and everything like that, we think that it's a safer alternative and we can better serve our kids by keeping our numbers lower.
The Mary Davis Home serves the six counties in the 9th Judicial Circuit in West Central Illinois and the four in the 14th Judicial Circuit in the Quad Cities and surrounding area. But when they have an opening, they will take youth from anywhere in the state. Steck says it's a rewarding and challenging job for staff who have to develop a rapport with troubled youth and de-escalate potentially violent situations.
Because we don't have weapons here, so all we have is our mouths, and we use our words as much as possible.
Steck says over the years, she's seen youth become more physically aggressive and less respectful, and the crimes they're charged with have grown more severe. 3 months ago, 8 staff members and 2 youth were injured in what the Knox County Sheriff's Office described as a riot inside the Mary Davis Home. Bridget Pletz says many of the youth live in poverty and in difficult family situations before they come to the Mary Davis Home.
And over the years, I've seen the generational effects of I have their parents on probation or their grandparents on probation, and now you're seeing the kids and grandkids come in.
Pletz is the director of court services for the 9th Judicial Circuit and has worked in probation since the late 1980s. For her, this work is about breaking the cycle through counseling, mentoring, and hands-on activities like playing basketball, gardening, and tie-dyeing shirts. This year, they also had a Juneteenth celebration.
Then they come in here sometimes with that chip on their shoulder still. And it's just us trying to knock that chip off, so to speak, so that they do change their behavior. And when they leave here, they can be productive out there in society.
The new standards for county juvenile detention centers were approved in 2021 and went into effect at the beginning of 2022. At that time, the Mary Davis Home still strip searched all youth during intake as a safety precaution for other youth and for staff. But since the first audit from the Department of Juvenile Justice in February of 2022, that is no longer practiced. Staff may only strip search youth with reasonable suspicion of weapons or contraband and with permission from an administrator. That first year, under the new standards, the Mary Davis Home was out of compliance in 8 areas, such as discipline, education, admission procedures, and mental health services. And there actually weren't state standards for most of those things until the last few years. For example, there were no state requirements for mental health services inside county juvenile detention centers. Wendy Steck says the former standards from 1998 primarily dealt with the physical condition of the facility.
They would come and make sure that our toilets worked and our water worked and the kids were being fed. And that was the end of our inspection. So it was a huge overhaul.
Steck says it's taken time to implement all that's required under the new standards. At the Mary Davis home, they've vastly improved medical and mental health services. There's new furniture and motivational posters on the walls to brighten up the space. They've implemented a behavior incentive-based program where youth can buy things like candy bars and fuzzy blankets in the new Mary Mart inside the facility. Last year, the Mary Davis home was down to 4 areas of noncompliance, and this year, the facility is down to 2.
It takes a while to get things moving in order to move towards those changes. You can't just change everything overnight because chaos will ensue.
The 2 areas of noncompliance this year were discipline and education. The most recent audit from the Department of Juvenile Justice states the Mary Davis home has made many improvements in the area of discipline, specifically the use of confinement. But the new standards mandate that confinement cannot be used for fixed periods of time. Instead, it can only be used until the youth is calm enough to rejoin regular activities. With behavior issues and staffing issues, Steck says that can be difficult to achieve there.
It's not that we're keeping kids in their rooms willy-nilly. It's that we are trying to make sure that they're safe.
On the education side, Steck says they're required to have 1 teacher for every 12 youth and 1 teacher for every 8 students with individualized education programs or IEPs.
Finding a special education teacher has been the biggest challenge that we've had. We do have someone for the fall that will be a great addition.
With the teacher shortage, general workforce challenges, and the demanding aspects of working with troubled youth, it's been difficult to recruit staff, and there's lots of turnover. To address that and help move toward compliance, the Mary Davis home increased salaries and waived bachelor degree requirements for counselors.
Obviously, our goal is to become in compliance with all of the standards. That's always been a goal of ours, and we will do it.
Outside of the Mary Davis home, people may see 3 years of noncompliance with new state standards. They may see the riot that made headlines, or a recent federal class action lawsuit from the ACLU claiming inhumane confinement and living conditions. But Steck says there may be misconceptions about what they do at the Mary Davis home.
We're not locking kids behind doors. You know, we're working with our kids. We're playing basketball with them. We're playing cards, or we're talking to them just one-on-one about their family and their home life. And we're trying to have fun with them and trying to get them to change, you know, their choices.
She says moving towards compliance with the new standards has been challenging, but it's making the Mary Davis home a better place for youth and for staff. I'm Jane Carlson.
Much like pedaling along a hilly trail, bicycle shops around Illinois have experienced ups and downs in recent years. Store owners and managers hope more outdoor activity this summer will translate into an increase in business. Joe Deacon talked with some bike store owners in the Peoria area.
Joe Russell carries a passion for biking that dates back nearly half a century, and he enjoys sharing that spirit with his customers at Russell Cycling and Fitness in Washington.
No surprise, but cycling to me is the world's most perfect activity. And I say that because good things happen when you ride a bicycle. And the excitement we've got is because of the fact that the bike is still, after all these years, which is more than 100, it still continues to be the world's most perfect machine.
Russell says the bike industry was in decline before the COVID-19 pandemic. But as other businesses got shut down in March of 2020, cycle shops suddenly began to thrive.
During the pandemic, we saw quite the surge, right? Ours is the one activity you got to do. In fact, even in our state, bicycle stores were legally allowed to stay open, a decree by our governor, because we were actually deemed essential for transportation. We cleaned out the store in 3 months' time, and the next bikes were 9 months away. And it was way past trained management to forecast what our needs were for 9 months out. You know, the crystal ball is a little cloudy.
But that surge didn't last. As Russell says, the wave has hit the beach. And now the restocked shops are having a tougher time moving their inventory.
It's down. It's certainly down from the pandemic levels, but those were abnormal. But back to 2019, pre-pandemic, we're a little below 2019 numbers.
Other bike shops in the Tri-County tell very similar stories. Rich Pestine is the owner of Bushwhacker, a bicycle and outdoor sports equipment vendor in Peoria's Junction City Shopping Center.
When COVID started, everybody wanted to get outside and do something, and bikes was a big deal. And people bought bikes that they never thought about it before. They thought, oh, this is fun. And so most of the bike shops, including us, close to ran out of bikes.
According to the retail tracking service Circana, increased interest in cycling pushed nationwide sales to $5.4 billion in 2020, a 64% increase. Last year, that sales figure was down to $4.1 billion. Pestine says that pinch definitely reached the local markets. Now they're seeing some recovery.
But slowly, there's still a lot of bikes out there, so it's a great time for consumers because there's lots of bikes and they're at very good prices now.
Jordan Skittlethorpe is the sales floor manager at Little Aids Bicycles in Pekin. He says the increased interest in biking has led to a boost in accessory sales and greater demand for repair service. Skittlethorpe says that while getting through the ups and downs over the last few years has been challenging, technological advancements in the bike industry offer reasons for optimism.
Biking's not going anywhere, for sure. I mean, now with the explosion of e-bikes that are coming out into the market, people are looking at bikes as more of a serious transportation thing. That's where a lot of the industry's probably going to go, is the electronic-assisted stuff. And then, you know, again, gravel bikes, they've become really fun for a lot of people.
Doug Carolis is the store manager at Trek Bicycle in Peoria Heights, one of the company's four locations in Illinois. He says despite the industry challenges, bikes are still selling and business has remained relatively steady.
I mean, it's not been the world's worst bumpy road. I think it felt more bumpy during COVID just because of all the restrictions and supply chain issues. So that made it a little bit more turbulent for us, but it's definitely kind of leveled off and settled back into still feels like it was better before COVID actually hit. Like, people have actually continued a good health trend and wanting to be outside more, but it's just becoming a little bit more at least stable versus complete chaos like it was around those times.
Doug Carolla is a bike store manager in Peoria Heights. He says the store has done well enough in 6 years they've outgrown their current location and plan to move to a larger facility. Joe Deacon brought us that report. We've got a conversation with Governor J.B. Pritzker on the way here on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Up next, we bring you a conversation with Illinois' Governor J.B. Pritzker. He spoke during the final week of June with the Illinois Lawmakers podcast, hosted by Jack Titchener and Jennifer Fuller. The governor talks about what state government is doing now and the vision he has for the future.
Welcome to a special edition of Illinois Lawmakers, coming to you from the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University in Chicago. I'm Jack Titchener, along with Jennifer Fuller, Broadcast Director for Capital News Illinois. Our guest is Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Governor, a little bit ago, you signed a $53.1 billion budget for the state of Illinois. Lots to unpack there, but it's very close to what you proposed in February of this year. What are some of the key points that actually emphasize your agenda for the state for the coming fiscal year?
Well, let me start with the fact that this was a balanced budget once again, 6 years in a row. We've received 9 credit upgrades. We had a real problem when I came into office, and that was that, you know, we had dug a hole. And you know what they say, when you're in a hole, the first thing you got to do is stop digging. So we had to do that for the state, and that means balancing the budget and then starting to pay off debts. That's what we've been doing the last 6 years. We've paid off more than $10 billion of state debt. We've invested in the things that I think are necessary for state government to operate, and we've done it in a balanced fashion. So that's number one. But we also passed a major healthcare reform, as you know, to make sure that the insurance companies aren't gouging patients, making sure that patients are getting the care that their doctors actually prescribe for them and not what the insurance company wants to intervene and tell you need. And a birth equity bill. You know, Illinois yes. has, unfortunately, a much higher maternal mortality rate for black and brown women than it should be. And so we made major investments there. You know, state government is operating at a much higher level and a better level than it was when I took office. We had a hollowed out state government. And today, much better. We've got, you know, better operations in the departments, as well as, you know, we monitor our fiscal health much closer than ever before.
One of your biggest priorities in each of your budgets has been education, whether it's pre-K through K-12 or even higher ed. There were increases and some big changes in terms of early childhood education this year. How do you prioritize that, and what's still left on the table there that you want to get done?
Well, you know, you can't make all the progress you want to make as governor or as a state that you, you know, you only have a certain amount of time. And in 1 year, you can't get it done. So you have to plan for years forward. And so you saw that the investments that we made back in 2019 continued 2020, 2021, and so on in education, which I think is maybe the most important thing we can do for the future of our state, whether it's our economy or the families of our state. So when you talk about early childhood, we're not where we need to be yet, but a whole lot better off than we've been in a very long time. Illinois, once upon a time, was the best state in the country for early childhood. We had philanthropists in Illinois who were focused on it, who created some foundation for us. And in fact, I, when I was a private citizen and involved only in business but philanthropy, I went to meet with them and really realized this is the best place for us to make investments for the future. And so I've been doing this for a quarter century, and we've made real progress just in the 5.5 years that I've been in office. So that's another area where, you know, we have more to do, but being able to get to universal preschool by 2027, that was not something that was on the table, I think, for anybody in the past. We're now going to get there. It's just 2.5 years hence.
That's the Smart Start program that for all the young kids, being ready to go to school when it's time to go to school. All of that fits into what was passed in Senate Bill 1, which creates a new Department of Early Childhood. That's been a major priority of yours.
It has, and I'm glad you raised that, because unfortunately, in state government, and this was true in other states too, you've got pieces of the early childhood development world in various different departments. So if you're a young mother and you want the best for your young child and you need help from state government, you're traipsing between multiple departments to find the things you need. Because the same child that needs preschool is the same child that needs childcare before preschool, is the same child that might need home visiting in the very earliest moments of their life. And yet you find those in different places. So that's an important thing that we're bringing together into one early childhood department. Now, there's going to be a lot that goes into it. It's not something you snap your fingers and all of a sudden the department is operating. This is a two-year process. And we believe that over the next 2 years, you're going to see better efficiency, but most importantly, you're going to see families being able to access the services that they need more easily.
Let me play devil's advocate, if I may. There's been some concern about this reorganization to an early childhood department, as well as in other areas of the budget. You yourself said that this would be a difficult budget year. Next year is projected to be perhaps an even more difficult budget year. With spending changes that you're making to early childhood and to other programs, are you concerned at all about the money running out or not being able to sustain a lot of these things that you'd like to be able to do?
You know, I think sometimes people overlook that when you talk about a state budget, there are one-time expenditures and there are ongoing expenditures. And the one-time expenditures roll off from year to year. And so, you know, the question is, what do you do with the dollars that roll off that you no longer need because it was a one-time expenditure, but you've got revenues that are still coming in? There are lots of options to consider, and I've tried to be rational about how we address that. For example, in this budget, people don't seem to talk about the fact that we implemented significant tax cuts for people, for small businesses, right? These are, for example, we have a child tax credit in Illinois now. Just a year or two ago, we implemented an earned income tax credit for the state. These were things that were going on at the federal government. Now the state is involved in helping families do better. Tax cuts. So small businesses, we cut the franchise tax in Illinois, and I've been doing that for a number of years since I came into office. And so people don't talk a lot about that, but those are some of the things that you can do with the kind of the as your revenue continues to come in, but the one-time expenditures fall off. You get to make choices about, are you going to cut taxes? Are you going to make investments that are necessary for the future? And I think we've balanced those things properly.
One of the cuts had to do with the elimination of the grocery tax from the state level. There was a lot of uproar from municipal governments because they get a share of that through the distributive fund. How did that eventually work out in terms of phasing that in?
Well, I'm proud to say that from the beginning of my time in office that I've actually pushed a lot more money to local governments. Literally billions more are going to local governments since I came into office. I thought it was a totally appropriate, and I think the vast majority of people in Illinois think so too, that we shouldn't be one of the nine states that still has a grocery tax. All the other states have done away with it. It's the most regressive tax you can possibly have. Everybody has to buy food to survive. And guess what? For someone who's poor, someone who's working class, it's more expensive to pay that as a percentage of their income than it is for someone who's wealthy, for example, or even somebody who's in the upper middle class. I think we should just do away with it entirely. That's what I said. Republicans agreed with me, and then, of course, decided as a political matter that they were going to come with their mayors and complain about it. We're sending a lot of money to mayors, we're sending a lot of money to local governments, and we're just asking that there be some relief in the form of this grocery tax.
One of the things that the mayors might find a little bit more positive is economic development, and you've spent a lot of time on that, particularly since the spring session ended, a trip to Canada for economic development, out to Washington, D.C. recently to talk about the things that Illinois wants to do to bring in new development, new businesses, particularly in things like quantum computing and other areas like that. How close are we to seeing something big or something that's really tangible people can see when it comes to these developments?
It's funny you say that because we've already seen some of those, and I think they go a little unrecognized. I'll give you an example. There's a company in East Alton called Veland, right? It was the old Olin Corporation. Very important in the history of the state of Illinois. It got bought by a German company. Very old facilities in East Alton. And they were considering getting up and leaving Illinois because they needed to build a new facility. And so they went and talked to Kentucky. They talked to a lot of other places. I went to visit their facility in Germany. It's true. The new facility they built in Germany is very much more efficient. And you can just tell that, you know, they needed to upgrade. So I sat down with the leadership of the company, the German company, the German CEO, and convinced him that he should stay in East Alton. And so some of the business development is now, we're talking about, it's resulted in $500 million new investment in East Alton, saving the hundreds of jobs, I think 800 jobs there in Southern Illinois, where we know there's, you know, been people who, companies that have left just because there hasn't been enough going on or they can't find the workforce that they're looking for. But we kept those jobs, and we're actually expanding because SIU is going to have a facility in which there's research and development going on for Veland. That's one example. I'll give you another one. We have a company called Rivian, as you know, in Normal, Illinois. Now, they came here on their own back in, I think, 2015 and took over the old Mitsubishi plant. But they're now doing much, much better. And I think you heard yesterday a major new investment in the company, $5 billion. But that company was going to build their second vehicle at a new plant they're going to build in Georgia. They're still going to build the first vehicle in Illinois, and we've got almost 8,000 employees. But I wanted the second facility to be in Illinois, but they wanted to diversify. So they went and they got billions of dollars of incentives from the state of Georgia. Well, guess what? They ultimately decided they're going to stay in Illinois. Now we're going to build, again, 1,000 plus more jobs and the new vehicle assembly line in the state of Illinois. Those are two companies that were in Illinois that might have expanded outside of Illinois that are now going to expand in Illinois. I just want to say one other thing. Quantum. This is a new industry, and electric vehicles is a new industry too. But quantum is one where we can be at the leading edge in Illinois. You know, we lost out in the internet, even though Mosaic, the first browser, was invented at the University of Illinois, even though PayPal and YouTube were at the University of Illinois. They all got up and left because state government didn't do anything to try to save the opportunity to be in this new technology, right? And no plan. Well, guess what? University of Illinois, University of Chicago, Northwestern, our other institutions here, national laboratories, all make us actually a hub of quantum development. And this is going to be, whoever wins this is going to become the Silicon Valley of quantum. That's going to be thousands and thousands of good paying jobs. So we're making the investments now. And that's the kind of economic development, bringing new industry, bringing the EV industry. Those are the things that I think are going to really punch up the future for the state of Illinois' economy.
How does this match up with the Biden administration's plans to do more domestic chip manufacturing here in the United States? And a lot of states have, they've got a head start on this, like California. How are we going to be competitive?
Well, actually, just to maybe reset you, quantum is an important part of a new revolution in technology. Semiconductors for quantum is a piece of that. But we actually are the hub of quantum technology here as a result of the work that University of Chicago and University of Illinois have done. We got more quantum grant dollars from the state of Illinois than any other state, quantum and AI, because they recognize that we're at the cutting edge here. Now, you're talking about semiconductors and chips. We've never been a chip manufacturing state. I mean, that's just not part of what Illinois has had. But this gives us an opportunity because those chips are being manufactured for quantum. And so we think there's an opportunity for us to maybe get into that industry.
There's been a lot of talk about some changes within the Illinois Department of Corrections, particularly with two facilities, one in Logan County, one closer to the Chicago area, the Logan Correctional Center in Stateville, to name them. There's a lot of consternation in those local communities. They want to keep the jobs there, but they also know that those facilities need a dramatic upgrade to bring them up to standard. So what is your administration doing in terms of making that plan available to the people who need to know and making sure that the progress moves forward as you've outlined it?
Well, nothing starts without at least studying the problem, and we funded the study last year to determine how are our facilities in Illinois for the Department of Corrections? Do we need to make changes? And they came up with an independent analysis, showed us that we have a number of facilities that need to be either significantly upgraded or replaced. And the significant upgrades would cost us just the same amount, basically, as replacing them. So let's replace them and upgrade them that way. We can build them for the modern era. Remember, the two facilities we're talking about, Logan, Stateville, one of them was built 150 years ago, one of them was built 100 years ago. They're not designed for rehabilitation. They're designed just pure punishment. And that's not the kind of system, penal system, that we operate in the United States anymore. So we know those need to be replaced. So we made that public, and we've been taking input from stakeholders. And I think that's going well. People are expressing themselves. You know, some people don't like the fact that we're making these changes. Some people don't recognize the need to make those changes, even though we have a study that shows that we do. And I would encourage people to take a real close look at the challenges that exist in these facilities. We're trying to keep people healthy in the facilities. Not just the prisoners in them, but also the corrections officers that work there. And I think we can do that best by making the investment to replace them.
One final question, and it has to do with trying to help some people wipe out their medical debt. That moved forward in the spring session.
Yes, it did, and I'm very pleased about that. I want to give credit to Tony Preckwinkle, the president of the Cook County Board, who actually started in Illinois doing this for Cook County. But now we're going to do it statewide. We're going to basically buy old medical debt from collection agencies so that people don't have this hanging over their heads. We can buy it at a penny on the dollar on average. And we can eliminate medical debt, and that makes a huge difference in people's future, whether they can, you know, get out from under the, you know, and you've seen President Biden going after student debt. We're trying to go after medical debt. So cheap to do, it's worth doing. And then we also passed a bill that Senator Steve Stadelman pushed forward to make sure that your medical debt does not anymore affect your credit rating. So I think collectively we're making real progress.
That's Governor J.B. Pritzker. He appeared on the Illinois Lawmakers podcast, and he spoke with the hosts Jack Titchener and Jennifer Fuller. You're listening to Statewide. Ahead on Statewide, we'll travel along by kayak with some teachers. It's an effort to help them in the classroom. But first, America needs more renewable energy, and of course it needs food. Those two demands are on a collision course over farmland. Solar power is the fastest growing source of renewable energy, but solar farms can take land out of crop production. As Frank Morris with Harvest Public Media reports, a growing field of study is searching for ways to get calories and kilowatts off the same land.
Across the river from an old coal-fired power plant near Lawrence, Kansas, a stiff breeze sweeps over farm fields. Scott Thelman, a farmer who grows a mix of organic and conventional crops nearby, loves this soil.
It's the best. It's absolutely the best our county and frankly our region has. Plants are really able to thrive here and continually, year over year, consistently produce an economically viable crop.
But it's also a convenient place to build a solar farm. And the county commission recently approved an 1,100-acre photovoltaic project here. Thelman hates losing land that's so well suited to crop production, and he's not alone. Congresswoman Mary Miller, an Illinois Republican, has introduced a bill that would force the USDA to evaluate the impact of solar farms on farm production. But in Ames, Iowa, researchers are looking for a kind of a compromise.
It's still a construction site.
Matt O'Neill, an entomology professor at Iowa State University, is opening the gate to a 10-acre plot that could help put the farm back in solar farm.
It's a solar farm. We're producing electricity. It's 1.8 megawatts, enough for 200 homes. But it's also a site for experiments.
The solar panels are at different heights. Some track the sun, some don't. So researchers can find out how various plants do in different growing environments. They're not growing corn and soybeans here, the big crops in Iowa. There's not nearly enough space. Ajay Nayat, incoming chair of the horticulture department, says they're focusing on fruits and vegetables.
And when we talk about fruits and vegetables, these crops or these plants love full sun. The first thing that strikes anybody is like, oh, is there enough light for the plants to grow? Which is a valid question.
In fact, there are a lot of questions. The ground under solar panels isn't just shadier, it's cooler, less breezy, and more humid. Naya's planting several different crops between, under, and around the panels, starting with his favorite, little shoots of broccoli, fresh from the greenhouse.
This is some very important broccoli.
This will be the solar broccoli. Yeah, but we are looking forward to this experiment.
Earlier experiments with what people call agrivoltaics haven't always gone so well. 3 years ago, a power company in Maine paneled over a field of wild blueberries. Lily Calderwood, wild blueberry specialist at the University of Maine, says the plants changed.
They look healthy, but they have more leaves because they're in the shade. And so any plant will grow more leaves and increase the surface area of their little solar panels to capture as much light as they can.
Problem is, they're producing a lot fewer berries, too few to justify the farmer's time and effort. So growing food on solar farms isn't easy, but it may be necessary. We're shutting down reliable coal-fired plants at the same time we're electrifying everything from transportation to cooking and heating. Matt O'Neill says a lot of that new generating capacity will come from utility-scale solar.
So are you going to have solar panels in farmland? Yes. Does that mean you can't farm? No. Are you going to be able to farm the way you used to? Probably not. There's going to be some adjusting. But that farming could be different, and could it be profitable? Well, that's the question.
It's an open question. Other agrivoltaics test sites have produced hopeful results, but on a tiny scale, too small for commercial farms. Back in Kansas, farmer Scott Thelman says agrivoltaics has become a buzzword, an unproven concept used to promote solar farms.
You know, I think there's potential. I don't know if we should be using our nation's best ag ground for it.
Thelman's worried that the rapid expansion of solar energy will take a bite out of Midwestern crop production before anybody figures out a profitable way to grow food on a solar farm. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Frank Morris.
The new state budget approved this spring cut operating funds for soil and water conservation districts in half, about $4 million. That's the money used to pay experts who advise farmers and other property owners about how to implement conservation practices, protect habitats, and conserve and restore wetlands. In an interview with Ryan Denham, Michael Jones with the Association of Illinois Soil and Water Conservation Districts says he's worried about the intergenerational impact of that cut, though they're not giving up.
We don't know where the breakdown happened. It's a confusing process. We know that we have a current administration that has been very supportive of soil and water conservation districts. We hope that maybe the process created its own little challenge, and we hope that we can maybe get the current administration to look at a supplemental budget in the veto session or the lame duck session. We know there's a significant amount of support from our legislators on both sides. And so we hope that we are able to find a path forward to get these funds reestablished in the coming months.
You've said that the Pritzker administration has historically been supportive of conservation efforts. What sort of explanation have you gotten from the administration about why this happened?
Only thing we don't have a solid explanation, but all I can say is there's a lot of competing initiatives with this budget. And I think that's what it comes down to is, there are just a lot of competing things, and I'm going to give that to them. I am reassured and feel positive when, you know, Director Costello has said that, no, we are still committed to conservation. I feel good about that. And I'm going to, you know, hold them to that word, and I'm going to continue to ask for their investments and their support. We provide support to the agricultural, you know, machine and engine to our state that is protecting our natural resources. I think we've got to make sure that we let all of our community members understand the importance of soil health and clean water. And instead of taking those things for granted, we've lived in a state that has been robust and vibrant when it comes to the agricultural sector, and maybe we've taken those things for granted.
So if this $4 million cut to the operating funds for soil and water conservation districts is allowed to just stay in place and actually happens, what does that mean? What kind of impact are you going to feel?
Well, and that's a tough question. And that's a lot of times people say what happens ultimately, right? I mean, if you were just clear cut, you know, if you cut 50% of your budget, that means potentially 50% of your front lines, boots on the ground, need to be reduced. It's not always that clear cut. What we have to do is go out and really try to identify other funds that can maybe backfill those gaps, right? And so that's one of the things I'm doing right now, really actively saying, how do we become more diversified in our portfolio of funding? We've been so aligned with a traditional model that I think we need to be looking at other venues. What it does, though, I can tell you, is we will have a significant reduction if we continue to stay at this path. Or my concern is the intergenerational reduction. It's not just what happens this year. Many of our frontline boots on the ground staff may be working on conservation, and it could take multiple years to get somebody to actually implement that practice. It may seem simple to throw cover crops onto the ground. The reality is remember, that only happens once a year usually, and you have to wait for the harvest in order to get that crop out there. Well, if we have a delayed spring because of a wet spring, that may cause, you know, delayed planting, that may cause delayed harvest. And if we have a wet harvest or a wet fall, that may not allow, or if we have an early harvest and we have an early cold spell, well, it may not allow for the planting of that cover crop, right? So there are a lot of variables. And so my concern is that these funding cuts impact some of the long-term plans that are already in motion, and then on top of it, delay the potential for future plans that may go forward.
Well, earlier you talked about the need to diversify funding sources. What sort of local funding opportunities are there for soil and water conservation districts?
Well, and I think that's where we need to start looking at. Now, remember, every time that we work with a producer to keep their soil in place and the water running clean, that means there's less water or less soil eroding onto ditches. That's less oil eroding onto, you know, parking lots. That's less soil eroding onto roads and so forth. So if we can start to get investments from other avenues, such as townships, counties, cities, you know, to help support, you know, putting conservation at the headwaters, then it reduces down the road other things that they need to do, like dredging ditches and putting in pollinators and all these kind of, let's utilize a resource that's here to help support that.
dust storms, the dust storm question. You know, soil conservation is one of the most effective ways we have to reduce the risk of dust storms, like we've seen here in central Illinois. And now our audience is hearing about this big budget cut to the operating fund of soil and water conservation districts. If this is allowed to stand, does that make it harder in the long run to protect ourselves from the risk of dust storms?
I think that it's a variable that plays into effect, definitely, because you're going to have fewer people out there working with individuals that are landowners that could be exposed to conservation practices. And with weather change, climate change, whatever term you want to utilize, bottom line is we know that we need to ensure that we put practices in place that preserve that soil, keep it in place. We don't want wind erosion. We don't want water erosion. We want that soil to stay where it's at. But we also want to make sure that that soil is then healthy and vibrant and alive. And one of the best things that we can do is to help advocate for cover crops. We can also begin to advocate more for reduced tillage, conservation tillage. We know we need to help address that.
That's Michael Jones, Executive Director of the Association of Illinois Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and he spoke with WGLT's Ryan Denham. Northern Illinois teachers spent a week learning how to teach their students about water and local watersheds. It culminated with a kayak ride down the Rock River. Peter Medlin floated down the river with his microphone to learn more.
We are officially out on the Rock.
A small group of teachers paddle south towards Rockford.
There's barely a cloud in the sky, a bunch of yaks on the water, feeling good.
This kayak trip was at the end of a free workshop from the University of Illinois Extension. The K-12 teachers soaked in lessons from local hydrologists, a geologist, and a soil specialist.
What you know about is what you take care of.
That's Peggy Annecy. She's an environmental educator with the U of I Extension who organized the watershed workshop. And teachers of all sorts took part, not just environmental educators. And because what you know about is what you take care of, the week started with a lesson on what a watershed even is. Annecy says you could think of a watershed like a bathtub. All of the water that falls into your watershed collects and eventually drains, like the tub drain in this simile, into a river, like the Rock, where we're kayaking right now.
So you have tiny watersheds that are in bigger watersheds, and eventually one-third of the U.S. drains into the Mississippi watershed. So the Mississippi literally drains a third of the United States, and that's our big watershed that we're in, and everything we put in it, from lawn care stuff to stuff down the drain, everything goes in your watershed.
You know, as I pull the microphone out, I really remember what a weird job I have sometimes.
Can I interest you in an on-the-river interview?
Chris Murafsa is a counselor at Hiawatha High School who's currently moving downstream alongside me.
It's almost like it changes your entire world.
He says he's learned so many things that are taken for granted.
There was a moment where we were in the water and looking at these macroinvertebrates and all of the larvae from caddisflies and all these things. And he's teaching us that these are bioindicators. These things are telling us the water's clean because they're able to live here. And I saw through his eyes that he's like, this is really clean water, and I'm happy about that.
As a counselor, he's probably not going to go back to school and do a water table activity with his students, but he wants to work with his fellow teachers to incorporate these resources and also tell his students about the career fields he learned about.
I advocate for so many things. That's what a school counselor does. I'm just going to add it to the list of things to advocate for. Let's care about our water. You live here too. Install some plants. That's all you got to do.
Jody Goodowitz is a science teacher at Sandwich Middle School.
From this week, I was just curious if there's things that you are particularly excited about taking with you back into the classroom.
I really think like the connection between soil and water and like the kids understanding that connection, I think is huge.
At her old school, a group of her students planted native plants to help prevent flooding behind the building, and now she's building up her new school's STEM program and figuring out how to incorporate environmental science.
Where am I going to find this grant money to make these kids do this class, but then design a rain garden for our campus and then, you know, be able to actually implement this, you know, design that they've come up
Becky LeBoule is a fourth grade teacher in Sominok, and as she paddles, she's looking for examples along the water of best management practices and erosion, and she's thinking about the passion the experts showed this week and how she'll bring some of those lessons back to her elementary school students.
How do we take care of our water and our soil? All of those things are things you can take back into the classroom no matter what age you work with.
Luckily, a few of her colleagues are out on the water learning too, and all of the educators, no matter their grade level, are hoping to use what they've learned to teach their students how to see their community in a new way, to show them how connected they are to their local watershed and the positive impact they can make. From the middle of the Rock River, I'm Peter Medlin.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. And don't forget to join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.